let yourself feel your body and relax. Just enjoy the presence of your body in this process of letting it become comfortable and relaxed. I'm going to slowly count to five, and as I count each number, as I say each number, let that be a cue to your body and mind to relax even more deeply. And just be aware of that sensation as it occurs. One. Two. Four. Five. Imagine a space or a place, scenery, that you feel to find yourself in at the moment. Maybe nature, maybe the ocean. maybe an enclosed space. See what your psyche gravitates toward in terms of imagining a beautiful and safe space, beautiful in its sense of safety, pleasing to you. And see if you can find a place to sit or be comfortable. In that space. And just allow the space to be what it is, and you to be what you are in that space, the mind to be what it is. Just relax completely into it and simply be present to it. Not identified with anything in particular, but just present to the whole. Notice the air and the scenery. The sunlight, the moonlight, and notice your own presence, how you are in the space, your being. When you're in an environment that is pleasing to you, that is safe, nothing threatening, where you can just simply be, the mind is restful and at peace. Notice yourself, your own presence in this environment. What is it like to be with you in this environment? mind is shifting or it can't find a place or can't find a place that it wants to be. Just sit with that as it is. Let it be. If the mind has a disturbance of any sort, just notice that. If you can just relax and be present to whatever happens to be there. Whatever the scene is, whatever the emotion is. Just be present to it without trying to shift it or change it. Shift the focus a little bit to you, the one that's present. Just notice your silent presence, what you are like, what your being is like. What is it like to be with you in a sense, now? ॐ भद्रं करने तिश्रनुयामदेवाः भद्रं पश्ये माक्षभेर्यचत्राः स्थिरैरङ्गैस्तुष्टुवागुंसस्तनूभिः यशेम देवहितं यदायुः स्वस्ति न इन्द्रो वृद्धश्रवाः स्वस्ति नः पूषा विश्ववेदाः स्वस्ति नस्तार्क्ष्यो अरिष्टनेमिः स्वस्ति नो बृहस्पतिर्दधातु ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः. Satyena labhyastapasa yesha atma. Satyena labhyastapasa yesha atma. Samyak jnanena brahmacharyena nityam. Samyak jnanena brahmacharyena nityam. Antasharire jyotirmayo hi shubraha. Antasharire jyotirmayo hi shubraha. Yam pashyanti yatyakshina doshaha. Yam pashyanti yatyakshina doshaha. Sandhi. Satyena labhyaha tapasa hi eshaha atma. Samyak jnanena brahmacharyena nityam. Antasharire jyotirmayaha hi shubraha. Yam pashyanti yatyaha kshina doshaha. Interesting verse. This verse is, to see this in the Upanishad is, it's a wonderful thing, actually. You keep seeing all of the things that we unfold, that when you see them at their source, it's such a nice thing to see. Here, this verse is talking about really the sadhanas for recognizing oneself, for gaining self-knowledge. And it's talking about the sadhanas that we call upayanishta and upayanishta. The upayanishta are the direct sadhana, the direct means for gaining self-knowledge, the pramana. It's really the shruti pramana, shravana manana nididhyasana. It's considered the upayanishta. Nishta gives that rootedness in the thing to be achieved, the thing to be known. And so how is it that you know yourself? What is the means of knowledge for knowing yourself? And so the Shruti will say, the means of knowledge for samyak jnanam, gaining that clear knowledge, clear without any doubt at all, is shravana manana nididhyasana, where shravana is the exposure to the pramana, to the unfoldment of the Upanishad, is the exposure to the vision. The unfoldment of the vision is shravana. And so that's in the Guru-Sisha relationship, the Upanishad, right, is what is being taught by the teacher. The teacher is teaching that Upanishad or the Bhagavad Gita or any of these Prakarana Granthas like Atmabodh, all of which are rooted in the vision of the Upanishad. That vision is being unfolded in a way to make the student see it. That's called the wielding of the pramana. That's shravana. Manana is then once the student sees what the Shruti is unfolding, all kinds of doubts will come up. Doubts can come up around whether or not the Shruti, the Upanishads, actually are a pramana. How can they be a pramana? All kinds of doubts around that. How are they a pramana? How do they function as a pramana? What does it mean for them to be a pramana? All of that has to be understood. So manana is going to be dealing with all the inquiry around the doubts that will come just around the Shruti as a pramana, the Upanishad actually being a valid means of knowledge to tell me the reality of myself in reference to this creation, in reference to God, in reference to this individual, that can really make me see that. How could that be true? How could it be a pramana? What does that mean? That's manana. We'll talk about, we'll deal with that with you. Deal with the doubts that come up around that. And then there's the shanka. Shanka means doubt. The doubt around the pramaya. What it is the Upanishad, okay, it's a pramana. I see it. It's a pramana. It works as a pramana. But what about what it's saying? How could that be true? How could one without a second be true? How could myself be, how could I be a changeless being? How is that possible? Are you sure about that? How is it possible? And so all of the doubts, all of the questions that come about in terms of what the Shruti is, that's the pramana shanka, doubts about what this Shruti is, how it works. And then doubts about the vision that it unfolds, because you can see it, and at the time of teaching you can see it, but often what you see will generate doubts. You see it, and then your mind will go, yes, but. And so the manana has to come in, because your mind has the freedom to really, really, really tussle with. It has the freedom to ask questions so that it can understand what it sees. The Shruti will make you see. The Shruti will give you direct knowledge, direct immediate knowledge for the adhikaris. We'll see that in a minute. We'll give direct immediate knowledge. You know? But then you need to understand what you see. That's where the nishta comes in, right? You can see it, but then your mind has to see it from all possible angles so that it's doubt-free, right? So that what it sees, it knows to be true. You know, good example is if I hold up a rose, do you see it? You see it with your eyes, but you don't know for sure whether this is a real rose or a plastic rose. You see it. You've seen the rose. You've recognized the rose. But now you have to convince yourself that this rose is a real rose and not a plastic rose. It's kind of like that, right? It's not, the job is not done. That's what I'm saying. The job is not done. There's some doubts. You have to come up and touch the rose. You have to smell the rose. You know, and even then there can be doubts because these fake roses are so real, right? Even then there can be, so you have to work with that, and then you can say, yes, this is a rose. Then you have jnana nishta around that rose, that one little rose. You have jnana nishta. You have no doubt. Even if somebody from across the room said, are you kidding? That's a plastic rose. I'm positive. You say, no, it's real. Prove it. Okay, come here. You can prove it. Right. You know, you don't have a doubt. Somebody says it's a plastic rose, you know that they don't understand. And so you help them to see that it's a real rose. That's jnana nishta. You know, and there's no wavering that takes place there, because you know. What about in terms of yourself? The Shruti takes you step by step in so many ways, wielding itself as a pramana. You see it, and you see it, and you see it again. Why do you have to see it, and see it, and see it again? Why can't you just see it? No. We need to see it, and see it, and see it again, because every time you see it, another doubt is generated. But what about this? And so then you have to see it from that angle. And so what about this? Then you have to see it from that angle. So the mind has to do this manana. It has to feel free to have doubts and then to reconcile those doubts. And just in case you don't have enough doubts, the Shruti will give you a lot of doubts. It'll give you the doubts and then answer the doubts for you. I bet you didn't think of this. I bet you didn't realize that you had this doubt. Well, here it is. It'll do the manana for you. You need to do the manana also. But the Shruti will make sure you do that manana. Manana comes from the root man. It means to think. Your mind has to think to understand what you see, to understand it thoroughly. That's the manana. And the third one is nididhyasana. Nididhyasana takes care of another kind of problem. The shravana, right, gives you the vision. The manana takes care of the doubts. Nididhyasana takes care of what we call this dehatma buddhi. Because even gaining this knowledge, right, you gain this, you see it, and then you remove the doubts, still your mind is habituated to acting as though you're the body. Just habituated, it's completely habituated to that. Nididhyasana is meditation on what you've recognized. It's not meditation to recognize something. It's meditation, contemplation upon what you've seen at the time of teaching. It's contemplating on the self that you are, right? On the self that you are, the self that you've already recognized. And what that does, that nididhyasana does, is it gives the mind time to come into relationship with yourself, right? The mind has to come into relationship with the reality of yourself. Because before knowledge takes place, there isn't a relationship. There's identity. There's no satyam mitya, right? There's no satyam mitya. There's just satyam, and this is it. Right? This is the satyam. This is the reality. This is the reality, this vyavahara, this world that we experience. This is the reality. I am this body. I am these sense organs. I am this mind. Maybe by some way I don't understand the soul. A soul goes up into heaven. But my experience of myself is this person here that sits before you. And the relationship with the mind and body is one of meanness. Right? It's not one of, let's put it this way. For the yajnani, or the one who's just suffers from this absolutely natural identity, that's natural, it's completely natural. When I sit and I say to you, I am me right here, this physical body, this is me. And I am this physical body who am thinking these thoughts and feeling these emotions. That's the experience. I am this person sitting before you, feeling these thoughts, talking these words, thinking these thoughts, talking these words, feeling these emotions. Here I am. That's the experience. What we need to recognize through nididhyasana is that this I, this presence, this me, the me that sits here before you is changeless. The very me that I'm taking now to be this physical body, which pervades this physical body, that is the self of this physical body, would be here exactly as I am if the physical body were to drop dead right now. If the physical body were to not be here, if the mind were to not be here, right, not exist, if the mind were not to exist, the sense organs were not to exist, the physical body was to not exist, were to go away, was not here. This me, the me that I take to be this physical body, because there's no distance between me and the physical body, would remain unmoved. Absolutely unmoved. It wouldn't go through the slightest iota of modification. So this I am, that I believe to be this physical body, because there's no distance, there's no separation between me and the body. There's no separation between me and the mind. Right? Now I have to recognize that the separation is the separation of satyam and mitya. In other words, I have to let this mind and body, we'll just stick with the mind now. I have to create a situation where this mind, I can slow everything down so that this mind, the thinking mind, the one that says, I am the body, or the one that says, I am the thought, or the one that has a perception or a feeling, I need to slow everything down so that I can recognize that, yes, the thought is there, the feeling is there, the thought is there. All of these things are there, coming and going. All of these things have being. All of these things have consciousness. Agree with me? Every thought that you have, it has being, it has consciousness. Right? It is, my thought is, and my thought is known. I'm aware of my thought. You all know that. But now what I have to recognize is that the isness of the thought, the me, the conscious being of the thought, never alters. It's not that hard to recognize. It's just a simple fact. The self, the conscious being that you are, never alters. The thoughts alter all the time. The thoughts have no being. They have no substance at all apart from you. Right? You are their self. You are the very conscious being that allows them to be known, that allows them to exist. You are their being. You are their existence. You are the consciousness which they enjoy. But there's a difference. There's something to be recognized about that relationship. Even though it's true that you are, the mind will say, I am the conscious being. I am the conscious being. It will say that. Because it is. There is no other conscious being there. So it's saying, I'm a conscious being. Every thought is like that. I am the conscious being. I am the conscious being. I am the conscious being. What it doesn't realize is that these thoughts that make up the mind and the moods and emotions that make up the mind are continually changing. And I, the conscious being, am not changing. That's what's missed by the mind. The mind says, I am the conscious being. It's because there is no other conscious being. The conscious being is the truth of it. I am the truth of the mind. I'm the self of the mind. I'm the very being of the mind. So that's not the problem. The problem is that the mind goes on changing. And then it says, because I go on changing, the conscious being, me, goes on changing. The mind goes on changing, so I go on changing. The body goes on changing, so I go on changing. That's the little faulty logic there. Right? That's the mistake. The mistake is not that I'm the conscious being, because there is no other conscious being. But the mind has to recognize that my presence, its very self, is changeless. This me, that when I say right now, I am me, this personal me, when I say that, I now have to recognize that this me, the me that I'm talking about, that is me, it is the very me that's the self of the mind and the self of the body. There's no distance there. It's not a difference of distance. It's a difference of satyamitya, in the sense that this me, my own presence, is always present, is always changelessly present. It doesn't flicker in any way. When the mind recognizes that, it recognizes, myself is changeless. The mind, which is always changing, always has one emotion after another, one thought after another, one perception after another. It's never still. It's always moving in one way or another. It's engaged in the world. It's part of the world. It is that mind that recognizes, myself, I am never moving. I never change. In spite of all of this changing, I never change. And so that's the differentiation. That's the relationship. The mind recognizes that itself is a stable self, right? Means that itself is what? Me. It recognizes, it differentiates. I, the one that illumines the mind, that is the very being of the mind, this I, never modifies in any way. And then what is the nature of this I, me? What am I like without all of the confusion, competing affects and moods and engagement of the mind? Because part of the problem that the mind has is that it's involved, always involved. It's involved in itself. It's involved in its own moods and emotions. It's involved in what everybody else is doing. Right? It's involved in all kinds of things. And that involvement is taking its attention. And so what happens in Nitta Dhyasana is that, first of all, we settle the mind down. We relax the mind, withdraw it from all of these involvements, and make it relax. We create an environment for it where it can just totally become quiet, totally relax. And then in that quiet, relaxed space where it's not now not involved in anything, we can then suggest to it, point to it, have it point it to itself, to the me. Let it come, let it recognize me, the self that is its very being, the self that is the conscious being that illumines it. Give the mind a chance to recognize me. But so we use words like, okay, now we've settled down the mind, what am I like? The one that is here. What is this presence me like? Why do we do that? Well, because so often the mind is so engaged in its own affect, in its own busyness, right? That the mind is not even in a position to recognize the nature of me, the me that is here. The me that is the self of the mind. So you slow that mind down and then let it recognize the me, myself as I am, simply as I am, without all of this all of these competing affects. So then if I say, well, what is this, what am I like without these competing affects? And then you recognize yourself, the self that you are right now, right? The very self that you are right now. You recognize that self in its own right. You as you are. You in your own right. Not you superimposed on emotions or emotions superimposed on you. But just simply you. The one who is present to emotions. The one who is present to perceptions. The one who is present to thoughts. The one who is just self-shining and abiding. The mind needs to get used to you. Right? It's used to being identified with you. Right? Not used to you. It's used to you as it. Now, so that means it's used to you only in terms of the changing phenomena that you experience. It's not used to you as the one who is just simply, changelessly here. And so Nitta Dhyasana gives you that space to recognize what that which after time, in fact, is never not recognized. Because once the mind recognizes, notice this. This is the problem. The me that you are is the me that you are right now. The me that you are, the me that is Brahman, is the me that the mind takes to be itself. See what I mean? There's no other me there. It's the me that is Brahman, that is the truth of you, is the me that the mind takes to be itself when it says, I am me. So what is the problem with the mind saying, I am me? The problem is one of identity, which means that every mood the mind has, I am. So when I'm depressed, when the mind is depressed, I'm depressed. When the mind is happy, I'm happy. When the mind is agitated, I'm agitated. There's basically no self. There's no stable self. That's the problem. That means that that's samsara. It means you're always being taken on a journey because you're always taking, the mind is always taking to yourself whatever colors it happens to be wearing. That is the problem. There is no problem at all in terms of the mind's identity when it says, I am me. It's just simply, you know, it's simply identifying the self, right? The problem is that then it takes itself to be that so that all of the changing that it goes through is superimposed on you. So now you have your mind, the same mind that has this problem, that's one problem of self-ignorance, now this mind has to do a moment of discernment. It has to recognize that, yeah, myself, is myself, but the difference is, the thing is that the self, the me, never changes. And so I, the mind that's always changing, the thoughts that are always changing, in fact, have no capacity to disturb my presence. That, you get that through, very helpfully through nididhyasana. You get it at the time of teaching, just with the flashes, you see it, and see it, and see it, and see it, and see it. But now your mind has to get used to it. You have to understand it logically, that's the manana. But then you have to do some nididhyasana, so the mind can break the dehatma buddhi. That's what nididhyasana is for, dehatma buddhi. The notion of the self, this me, being the body. That's the mistake. So I have to, the mind that says, I am the conscious being, has to recognize that, yes, I am the conscious being, but asatyam mitya. Right? It's like the pot recognizing I am the clay. It's true. I am the conscious being, but I am changeless. You can say that, you're home free. If you can say, talking just to it, my body, I am the Atma. I am the Self. I am the conscious being. My mind is the conscious being. My sense organs are the conscious being. My body is the conscious being. I am that. And I never change. Can you say that? I am that. Can you say, I am that? I am that conscious being, and I never change. That's perfect. Talking even from the mind, the mind can say, I am the conscious being, and I, the conscious being, never change. That's right. Then you get it. You get it. See, the thing is, what's beautiful about being able to say, that's the satyam mitya. What's beautiful about being able to say that is because then, finally, you're not seeking for some conscious being somewhere. The big problem, one huge obstacle, is we have an idea of something in our mind, you know, an idea of this conscious being we're supposed to discover. We have an idea of it, the supreme consciousness, you know, or the big S, the big self, or some sort of conscious being that is somewhere. The hardest thing to understand in this teaching is that the conscious being that we're talking about is the conscious being that you already take yourself to be. The me that you accept right now as yourself is Brahman. That's why the satyam mitya, you have to understand it so that you can say, that's what it is. You have to be able to say, I am the conscious being, and I never change. The mind can say, I am the conscious being, I am the self, I am the Atma. From my standpoint of my body, I can say, I am the Atma. This me that I take to be me is the physical body. This me that I take to be the physical body, this me is Brahman. This me that I take to be the physical body, this me, this very personal me that makes me me, it is this me that is Brahman. Right? It is this me that is changeless. Now, if it's this me that is changeless, do I experience myself as changeless? Actually, you do. Actually, you do. You've never experienced yourself as not changeless, because you are the one present. This me is the one present to all experience that you have. You never go anywhere. The experiences go everywhere, right? All the experiences are going. They're all going, 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 going in your presence. You never modify in any way. So that's why it's really not that complicated to tease this out. Because in fact, you're the only thing that is always here. And so, and if you say, well, yes, just think for this language, you say, yes, I am always here. in all experience that I have, I am here. I am the stable. I'm the stable presence. That's true. You haven't gone anywhere. Experiences. All the moods have gone. They've all come and gone. Right? All of the thoughts have come and gone. The perceptions have come and gone. Quick. But I have no sense that I have come and gone. Do I? You can say, I was sad, then I was depressed, then I was happy, then I was agitated. You know, I was well, then I was sick, then I had the flu, then I had this, then I had that, and now I've got my health back. You know, I was 30 pounds heavier, and now I've lost it all. The one who is 30 pounds heavier is the one that has lost it all. But yeah, it's your experience. So what I'm trying to point to is that is your experience. The stability of your presence is your experience. That the stable me, you are always here. But that stable me that you are needs to be consciously differentiated from the changing experiences. And that's the nit of the asana, where you sit with yourself and you recognize, and you can, with your mind, you can even say, okay, try to change me. You know? Try to alter me. And you know, it's not possible. It's not possible because your own presence, is not an object that can be touched. Your being, the consciousness, is not an object that you can touch. Being is not an object that you can touch. You can't look and say, oh, look at the being, let me grab on to some of it. Look at my existence, let me grab on to something. Even internally, with your mind, you go internally and you say, I think I'll just grab a piece of consciousness inside. Or I'll just alter my existence a little bit. There's nothing that you can do to... It's not something that you can alter or touch because your being is not an object within time and space. Right? This is a very important point to recognize that your own self-experience, this me, is not something that exists as an object in time and space. In fact, it's impossible for me to recognize I am the whole, that I am all of this. I can't recognize I am all the whole. I am the whole. If I don't understand that consciousness and existence is not something that you can have an objective experience of. This is the problem. When you're looking out at the world through your sense organs, which is what we do, that's what gives us dimension. All right, look, we're in a box here in this room. We're all sitting here in a box within their spatial dimension. Right? And so I see over there. I hear over there. I touch out here. Right? And so to recognize that all of this creation that I'm experiencing, right, all the existence, that all of this enjoys being, which is myself. It's a little digression, but I'll come back in a minute. All of this enjoys being. It is. It exists. I give existence to it. Right? You say, yes, it all enjoys existence. It all is. We give existence to it. And I'm conscious of all of this. But I don't have an experience of myself being all of this. Right? Well, I don't. It's like, because we go back into this Dehatma Buddhi in this way. My consciousness, my experience of existence and consciousness only goes to the skin. That right? It doesn't go beyond this. Even with the skin, even with the body, it's a superimposition. Even this is a superimposition. But my sense of of consciousness in existence stops here. Because my Dehatma Buddhi, the Dehatma Buddhi, doesn't fill the room. Does it? It's like your sense of me only stops at the body. It doesn't, you know, extend and fill the room. And so if I were to be the whole, this is how somebody might think like this, if I were to really know that I am the whole, shouldn't my sense of me extend instead of just stopping at this body? And this is wild, but still I'm going to do it. Shouldn't this sense of, to really know, to really have the experience that I am the whole, shouldn't the sense of me extend out to fill the whole? Because now just as a jiva, I have this sense of me, that this body is me. Right? So, if in reality I am Ishwara, I am the whole, shouldn't the sense of me extend? See what I'm saying? So then I can say, now I experience myself as the whole. Because people want to experience themselves as the whole. How do I know that I'm the whole? You know? What kind of experience is that going to be? Is my sense of touch going to all of a sudden pervade out into the world so I can, this whole thing will you know, feel like it's my body? Is that what's going to give me this experience that I am the whole? That this is all nothing but me? How do I know that? You know? How do I have nishta in that? You know? So now, is everybody with me on this little doubt? I'll tell you in order to recognize that, in fact, at this moment, at least as far as my sense organs go, like how far do they go? Well, they fill up my sense organs for now, except for my sense of hearing that'll extend a little farther. It fills up this room, right? And so I can have right now as a jiva, I can have an experience of this room through my sense organs, with some extension brought about by my sense of hearing that will take me out into the park. Right? So I can have now a direct, immediate experience of this room. That's true, you know. But I don't take the room to be me. But it's true that I am having a direct, immediate experience of the room. But that doesn't make the room me, right? I can even say that I can go like this. I'm having a direct, immediate experience of this room through my sense organs, right? And there is nothing in this experience that I'm having that's away from consciousness. Can I say that? Because the whole thing is known through my sense perception. So I can also say that. It still doesn't make it me. Okay. Now, why not? Why not? Well, just on a simple level, let's look at it. This is Dehatma Buddhi. I am having an experience of this room. Right? Actually, if I were to break it down a little farther, what is actually happening is that through my sense organs, if we just look at what is actually happening here, through my sense organs, my mind is having a thought modification of the room, right? Because actually, even if my sense organs were open, but my mind was daydreaming, I would be aware of the daydream. And so really, the experience that I'm having an experience because I have sense organs that are focused on the room, and my mind is using those sense organs. So what I'm actually experiencing is the mind, which has in it a thought of the room. So I'm actually experiencing right now a thought modification of the room. We can say, yes, that's true. Okay. Right? Now, I can also say, now, just look at the thought modification of the room, which is the reality of your experience at this moment. Does any part of that, this thought modification enjoy more awareness than another part? It's an interesting question. But I would say, no, actually, the entire thought is only, it enjoys me equally. Right? Because I illumine the entire thought. The entire thought is known. The entire thought enjoys my being, in fact. Once I get into the mind, right, this is simple. Once I get to the mind, the entire thought enjoys my awareness. The entire thought enjoys my being equally. I am the truth of that thought. Right, I can say that I'm the truth of that thought. Isn't that right? So really, if you think about it, in terms of what you are experiencing, once we break it down like that, you'll say, yeah, this entire thought that I'm experiencing has me for itself. It has me for itself. I'm the consciousness which it enjoys, and I'm the being which it enjoys. In fact, that thought can go. I can shut my eyes or I can daydream, and that whole thought will go, and then I am the being and the consciousness that that thought enjoys. Right? So when we break it down like that, it becomes clear. However, I'm this body. In my experience, now we've stopped breaking it down like that and we're back into the room. This Dehatma Buddhi, this identification with the body, is so profound because the five sense organs, right? The five sense organs are located here. They have their sthana here. Their sthana means they're located here. And so what happens is that from my perspective, I'm located in the body seeing you. That's my experience. I'm located here in the body seeing you through these sense organs. I'm experiencing you through these sense organs. And the sense of touch goes through this whole physical body, right? And so my self-experience with the subtle body is, it's profoundly contained in this body. So now what we have to do, that's Dehatma Buddhi, right? That Dehatma Buddhi is so convincing that it stops me from actually recognizing the reality of my actual experience of being the whole. Okay, so now I'm going to go back to it just one more time. We've got to get to this verse in a minute. Okay. Let's go back to it one time. Think about this again. I'm seeing this room through my sense organs. That's true, right? Included in this room that I'm perceiving through my sense organs is my physical body. So actually, in fact, this room that I'm perceiving, the perception includes my physical body. Right? If I were to get rid of sense organ by sense organ by sense organ, if I didn't have my eyes, I wouldn't see you, but I wouldn't see the physical body either. So this physical body is part of the thought modification. If I am perceiving this world, right, I'm perceiving this world through my sense organs, and that's forming a thought modification in my mind, and then I, the conscious being, illumine and am the very self, the very existence with which my thought enjoys, included in that thought is the recognition of the body, the cognition of the body. If you don't think so, get rid of your sense organs one by one. Get rid of your sense of touch. Get rid of your sense of sight. Get rid of your sense of hearing. You're eliminating your cognition of the physical body. And so, but that cognition, that Dehatma Buddhi, is so very strong that what we have to continually do is give the body back to Ishvara. We have to recognize that this body, as much as the rest of the creation, belongs to Ishvara. It belongs to the creation. Now, it's easy for me to give you all to Ishvara, you know, because it's true that you, all of you, are obviously, you are obviously part of my thought, right? And you obviously enjoy the thought modification, enjoys the conscious existence of me that illumines, right? That's why this I am the whole, right, can't really work until I in terms of really recognizing the truth of it, until I'm able to give every part of this body, mind, sense organs that I identify with as being me to Ishvara. Just like I give all of you to Ishvara, I give space, air, fire, water, earth, I give the creation to Ishvara, right? And giving all of these things, once they're all given to Ishvara, which is not a real feat, that's easy, right? Then I can see all of this is Ishvara, all of this is Ishvara. But I'm leaving myself out. I'm leaving my body out. I'm leaving my mind out. I'm leaving my sense organs out. I'm leaving my moods and my emotions out. I'm leaving the ahankara out. And then when I leave that out, then I become me, and this becomes Ishvara, perhaps. But I can't feel like Ishvara. I can appreciate Ishvara. I can appreciate Ishvara. But I can't feel like I am Ishvara because the Dehatma Buddhi is still there. No. So now, just experientially, what do I have to do then? This is one thing that I think can help. Of all of the sense organs that I experience as a jiva, the kicker, the one that makes it difficult, is the makes this Dehatma Buddhi so real, is the sense of touch, right? That pervades the whole body. Even though you know, like I've told stories and about my good friend who's a paraplegic. We used to play games. And he'd have me, you know, stick a needle into his leg, just poke his leg, you know, because he couldn't believe that he couldn't feel it. It shut his eyes. No. Oh, and I wouldn't poke that hard. You know, just because he could not believe that somehow he had to know. It's just inconceivable. But he didn't know. We tried it a few times. It freaked him out. We never did it again. Inconceivable. Because your mind makes these kind of adjustments. So what for it? You know, like if you're paraplegic, if you see your legs and you have feeling up here, then you kind of just somehow extend it. But if you were to shut his eyes and be touched, no sensation whatsoever. No, nothing. Okay, so now, what I'm saying is that, however, if you bring to consciousness the fact that your sense of touch, that this sense of touch that you have is a sense organ, and because of your sense of touch, you feel this, feel the chair. Because of your sense of touch, you feel this body. Because of the sense of touch, this is known to you. This is felt. This cloth is felt. Because of the sense of touch. Because of the sense of touch running through your entire body, you have a felt experience of this body. Right? You have a visual experience of it. You can hear it. You can taste it. You can smell it. You can feel it. Feeling is also a sense of touch. Believe me, if you lose it, you will know. Right? But we don't usually make that discernment. That here, when you're sitting with this physical body, that you're having a sensation of it through the sense of touch. And so if you understand that, then when you're objectifying all of the things that are taking place in your awareness, all of the things that are differentiated in a sense as satya mitya from your awareness, you need to differentiate from your awareness, the conscious me, the conscious being that you are, you need to differentiate the sense of touch. Often we don't do that. If you differentiate the sense of touch so that you recognize your own presence and then the shifting physical sensations of the body, you know, and then you recognize your own presence, the stability of your own presence, and the in and outgoing breath, for instance. You recognize your own presence then also in terms of your perceptions. You recognize your own presence in terms of sound. What you start to recognize that all five of these sense perceptions enjoy me. All of the sense perceptions, including the sense of touch, equally enjoy me. Now, let me say what I mean here. Right now, if I look across the room, and so now I'm having a visual of this room, right? I can say, this perception is in my awareness. It enjoys my awareness. And can I also say that the existence that it enjoys is the existence that it enjoys that I'm giving it. Now think of it like this. The existence that this room enjoys, am I perceiving the existence that it's enjoying? Because I say, here it is, this room exists. How do I know it exists? Because I'm perceiving it. You have the perception, but what's giving it its sense of being? That's what I mean. This perception, you're having a perception, what's giving it its sense of being? Nothing that you're perceiving, what's giving it its sense of being is being itself, the being that you are. There's no other being that this perception is enjoying. It's only enjoying your being. So now what you need to do is to recognize, you need to differentiate your being. What is this being, this conscious being, right, that this perception is enjoying? If that's the me, that's me. If you can recognize that this perception is enjoying your being, can you recognize it in the same way that your sense of touch, the perception of this body, is enjoying your being? That's the degree to which this differentiation has to take place. That's why when we do, say, a meditation, Swamiji used to always do this one, you know, where you're sitting in the room and then you recognize, you feel your physical body, and then you recognize it as a statue sitting in the room along with all the other bodies, and then you recognize how it's a breathing statue. Every time you do that, you're objectifying. Now you've got a breathing statue. Now you've got a thinking, breathing statue. Right? Right? So now all of these are all sensory perceptions, but every time that you're doing that, you are objectifying and differentiating it from your own presence. Right? Now what's happening is that the being, the conscious being, is being differentiated from these things that are objectified and then given to the room. Why are they all given to the room? Why is this body put into the room? These sense organs put into the room? Like you're in the room, you're in the room, you're in the room. This body's too in the room. Your sense organs are in the room. These sense organs are in the room. Your mind is in the room. I can see you have a mind, you have a mind, you have a mind. This body is a mind too. They're all put in the room. Why? Because we have to differentiate the self-experience of existence, being, the me, from these experiences, so that we can recognize that all of these experiences enjoy me equally. We can't do that if there's a Dehatma Buddhi. Because if there's a Dehatma Buddhi, then the only way means if this body, mind, sense organs are not given, objectified equally with everything else, right? Then this body will enjoy me more than everything else. This body enjoys me more. And so then for me to recognize I am the whole, I have to extend my body. It sounds silly, doesn't it? But our mind will do incredible things to hang on to that Dehatma Buddhi. Once the body, mind, sense organs and the I thought, and all of these things that can be objectified, belong to Ishvara, right, as much as everything else, then the existence that is me, and only me, right, the consciousness that is me, and only me, that existence and consciousness, which is Ishvara, which is the self of Ishvara, this is the tricky part. It's not tricky, but it just, you have to get it. It is what it is. In itself, it is complete. That isn't going to change. It's not going to pervade anything. It's not objectifiable. So nothing's going to happen. It's not going to change. It's just going to stay as it is. But now it's not attached to anything in particular. Right? Because it's not, in fact. But now you've recognized that. And so now, if you know that, now here you are, this body, mind, sense organs, experiencing the world, right? Experiencing duality. But the being that all of this experience enjoys, including your body, including your mind, including your sense organs, is only me. Because you can't objectify me, and there's no experience that's away from me. Right? There's no other me experience, and there's no experience that's away from me. And so right now, if you think about it, if you get rid of this Dehatma Buddhi, and you let the body and the mind and the sense organs and everything be part of this experience, the objectified experience that you're having, right? There's no part of this experience that's away from your being. Like this. What part here in your experience, what part doesn't exist? Nothing. The problem is that you think that the experience of being should, in order for you to be the whole, should be objectified. The experience of being should be objectified, perhaps, somehow. But it's not even that way for Ishvara. The experience of being isn't objectified. It just is what it is. And nothing at all is apart from it. That's why, another thing here, in your meditative practice, it's helpful. One of the Achilles heels that helps you to understand this. You have a little, as a jiva, you have a little bit of maya to play with. Bhagavan gave you maya. You have imagination. You have dream, right? You have imagination and dream. If you've got that, then you can create a universe in yourself. You just imagine one. You can imagine one and you can enter it. You can walk around in it. There's no problem there with seeing I am the whole. Is there? You have an imagination? Even if you enter, you no problem saying, I am the whole, because you're Ishvara there. Here you have to be able to say, I am the whole, being identified with the jiva, being identified with this body. But really, there isn't any difference. There isn't any difference. Because as in this level of reality, right, at this level of reality, you're also not this body. You're not this body. Now, if you have an imagination and you enter that imagination as a body, you take a body in that imagination, you're not that body. You're Ishvara. And that's your experience. You know? But you've got Nishta there. You have Nishta. Here, the Nishta is with the Dehatma Buddhi. Right? But if you take a form, you see you have an imagination and you take a form and you're looking at the world through that those sense organs, still your Ishvaratvam is going to be stronger because it's your imagination. Here, from this standpoint of the Jiva Upadhi, what's strong initially is the Dehatma Buddhi, because you're the one who's ignorant. You're the one suffering from the ignorance that needs to be liberated. Right? And that ignorance is so entrenched. So you can see what has to happen. This body, mind, sense organs has to be given to the creation. How can I do that? How can I give this to the creation? I can't until I've differentiated myself. And then if I've differentiated my being, once I've done that, once it's differentiated, then I have to give it to the creation. If your self is differentiated, you know what I mean? If you've done that drisha, if you've completely recognized, right, the independence, the changelessness of your being, absolutely the changelessness of it, then this becomes part of this whole. But until that happens, this is where the identity takes place. Okay, so now. It says, just these two lines we're going to do. These few words. Esha Atma. So important. This Atma. Esha Atma. This self. That's what it means. Esha Atma. This very self that's here. Samyak jnanena. This very self is gained, right? Labhyaha. This self is gained. Samyak jnanam. Simply by clear knowledge. How does that knowledge take place? And the Bhasha Shankara talks about it. How does that knowledge take place? Through Shravana Manana Nididhyasana. You have to see it. It has to be seen. It has to be recognized. It has to be understood thoroughly. That's how you gain it. Because this Atma, Esha, this Atma is already here. It's already you. And so the only way you're going to gain it is through knowledge. Because it's not a problem. It has nothing to do with changing or reaching or going anywhere. It has to do with recognizing. So the Shravana Manana Nididhyasana, that understanding, you need to see it clearly and understand the logic of it. And then you have to experience it. You have to understand the experience that is here clearly. So this part, this is the Upaya Nishta, that Shravana Manana Nididhyasana effort through the Samyak Jnana, that has to be very clear. But then it can't be clear, this is the second part, we'll work on this next week. That knowledge, it can't be clear without Antakarna Shuddhi. So the mind has to be, if the mind has to be, have a certain level of freedom. So here it's going to say Satyena through telling the truth, through Brahmacharya, through living with the teacher, serving the teacher. There's a lot to Brahmacharya, we'll talk about that. Through tapas, through living a religious life. All of these things are necessary just to give the mind a certain equipoise and freedom, relative freedom, so that it's free enough to see this. Otherwise, the mind's too engaged out here. It's too engaged with itself because of its own pain, or it's too engaged in the world because it needs this or that or that. And so the mind has to be reined in. It has to be relaxed. It has to be reined in and relaxed so that it can recognize this. Otherwise, it's not in a condition to recognize it. And so that's what they call upayanishta. So what Shankara said in this, in his commentary, you know, everything is in this verse. The whole vision is in this verse, and the means for gaining that is in this verse. So it's a very, very important. It's got both what we call the sadhanas that are necessary for gaining a mind that is capable of seeing it, plus the means of knowledge that are necessary, the shravana, manana, nidha, dhyasana, that are the direct means of knowledge for understanding. So, you know, that was interesting. We'll work on it later. As you're just sitting here quietly, just for a moment, feel your body through the sense of touch. And now listen to the noises outside through your sense of hearing. Now see if you can differentiate both. The noises and the sensations of your physical body. From the me, from your own presence. Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
What was that? Upaya Nishtha again?
Upaya.
Yeah, I thought that was that's a teaching methodology. Prakriya and
the upaya stands for the means. The means for gaining this knowledge, meaning the mind. What's the instrument? So gaining the instrument, the antakarana.
Okay.
Making an adhikari of the antakarana. Making your mind an instrument that's able to gain this knowledge. Right? And the upaya is the direct means of knowledge. So your mind has to gain it, but then you need the means of knowledge to give the mind the knowledge that it needs to gain, that your mind has to be available for it. Yeah. So, in this verse, two verses on this, satyena, through the truth, through telling the truth. It's a value. It's going to be what we call upalakshana. Upalakshana means this particular value is going to be the value they use to include all of the values. But it's the primary value to tell the truth, honesty, because the mind becomes too... say if you lie, it's a lot of work. Yeah. To keep up the lie, your mind is not free then to relax. It has to keep up the lie. It's very hard to keep up a lie. You can't even remember what lie you told.
Yeah. Which one?
Say if you tell a lie, then you have to remember the lie that you told, mm-hmm. and to who.
Yeah. And then you got to stick by the story.
Yeah. It's very, very, very stressful. It creates a lot of conflict.
So it's hard to learn the source of study of being a politician.
But if you think about the stress that lying causes. One thing that people get confused though about this satyam is that, well, if you don't tell a lie, that means you have to tell everything you know. No, you don't. If you hold these two things, that what you say, this is what they call vaktapas. What you say, it should be satyam. It should be true. But it also should be hitam. It should be beneficial and useful. And it should be priyam. It should be kind. It should be pleasing. Right? Those are the things that you say. You don't have to say for utter, another thing for this vak means speech, is arjavam. Arjavam means that you should be straightforward. What you think and what you say should be in alignment, right? You don't think one thing and then you say another. What you think is what you should say, but you shouldn't. You definitely don't need to say everything you think. Because what you're thinking may not be, you may be thinking it, but it may be inappropriate to say. Yes, that doesn't make you a liar just because you're circumspect around what you decide to actually say. But what you do say should be true. You know? And if it is, then your mind, you know, you can relax. And also, even internally, Swamiji started it actually when he became more psychologically and kind of enjoying or seeing the value of psychology. He was talking even about in terms of your own honesty to yourself. You know, being able to face yourself, how you really feel or what you really are thinking about something, or instead of running away from yourself. That type of objectivity and honesty, yeah. and toward others, it just unclutters the mind. It's a beautiful value because it gives the mind freedom, you know, freedom to relax, and you can't have that if you don't tell the truth. So another, and I think it's in this. Next verse, it says, it's satyena, it's through this satyam, through this telling the truth. This telling the truth is the kind of the royal road of the gods. It's the royal road of the gods. Toward this antakarana shuddhi, it gives you the type of mind that can hold this knowledge. Otherwise, the mind can't relax.
When the mind gains knowledge, then in a sense it's known in some way that it's like one of Ishvara's minds gaining knowledge, right? In a way, if you've given your mind Ishvara, then you're the self, And one of Ishwara's minds gained knowledge.
Yeah, you could say part of Ishwara. Yeah. That's right, because on that level, you know, there is only Ishwara. And so every jiva, everything is only part of Ishwara. Right? But then within Ishwara, we make this distinction that this jiva and this jiva and this jiva and this jiva, but actually there is nothing away from Ishwara. Everything's a manifestation of Ishwara. Everything's held by the same laws. Everything is Ishwara. Just think of it like this. If you have a dream, all of the characters are in the dream. All of the jivas are part of the dream, including one you might be identified with. Are they Ishwara or not? Because they're all part of the same Maya, part of the same fabric. So there's nothing about you that isn't Ishwara. Dharma and adharma, all of it. Because dharma and adharma all are because of the order, which is Ishwara. Right? So if you veer away from dharma, then you have an experience of pain. That's how it is. And pain is part of Ishwara also. Pleasure and pain, all the emotions, everything. It's part of the order.
You know where I get hooked up sometimes is I think of, you know, we have a my body, and my mind. Also that my consciousness, you know. There's a problem with that, right?
Yes, because that's the ahankara. The ahankara identified with the ahankara means I notion. So the I notion, the ahankara identified with the mind, says my consciousness. So that's why we say, where is this I, the I thought, where is it landing? We want the I to come from the Atma. And the Atma is not going to say my consciousness unless it's doing self-reflectively, just in language. But I am consciousness. It's not my consciousness. When you say my consciousness, then you're identifying consciousness with the body or consciousness with the mind. Because, right, when you say my consciousness, then where's the ahankara speaking from?
Yeah, I'm not quite sure where it lands at that moment. Yeah.
Yeah, so that's what you need to look at. Say, well, wait a minute, I'm the conscious being. I'm the conscious being illuminating
the mind.
So
there's nobody that owns the consciousness.
Yeah, consciousness is consciousness. The me is me. Right? It's not owned by anyone. It's not owned by anything. It's that's what we mean by self-evident. There's nothing, it's not attached to anything. Right? And your own presence is also, it's not...
My presence?
Yes,
the
me.
it's me presence.
The me presence, the me.
Okay,
right?
Yeah.
Well,
the me that I am, it is this me that is Ishwara, right? Is Brahman. There aren't two me's. It's only one me.
But from the standpoint of the mind,
yeah.
Like when we're talking about the beloved and this sort of thing, then we could say my consciousness, my beloved, because then
as long as you know what you're saying.
Yeah.
You have to know what you're saying. Yeah. You know.
You know, with the Dehamabuddhi, the going through this, you know, perceptually, you know, vision and touch and all that, that works really well for me. But when I think I still get hung up with, well, but I can, you know, I have control over the action of this body, but I don't have control of the action of somebody else's body or something across the room.
That's true. You can move this body.
I can move this body.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah,
and I
yeah.
I can move someone else's body. So when you think, am I more present in my body, in this body, than in the bookshelf or in somebody else's body? I think I am because I feel like I am because I can move this body. I can't move this.
That's true. Of course, once this is not direct, but I'll just say it anyway, not directly related. What I was thinking, what came to my mind was, you know, this body is when it's a dead body, when the subtle body is left, mm-hmm. right? And now you're with the subtle body. You can't move
that
dead body. It's dead.
And like sometimes
the morphal coil has been.
Or like when you're asleep and you sort of sort of wake up, but you can't yet move your body.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. But even then, that's true that I have motion over this physical body as long as I do. Right? As long as I can move it, nothing's happened to it. I've got a subtle body that's indwelling this. But that's what makes this so seemingly real, really me, compared to the things that I can perceive through my sense organs, but not through my sense of touch. But right, yeah, you can move this and all. But that's why this objectification and differentiation is so important. Because this body which I can move is also an object of my awareness. Right? And your body which you can move is an object of my awareness. I can move this and I can see you that you move yours. But all of them are equally objectified. And you have to recognize that you say you can move your body. Is awareness moving it? Is awareness moving your body? No, no. Your subtle body is moving your body because awareness doesn't move. So when you say, I'm moving my body, also that's part of Ishwara.
Yeah.
That motion belongs to Ishwara.
Yeah, yeah. So when he says, I'm moving my body, that feeling,
yeah,
that is actually, Ishwara is moving this thing around.
Well, what I meant by that, but not exactly, that's not exactly what I meant, because the jiva, the subtle body, is moving this body, and your subtle body is moving your body, and all of that. What I'm saying is that Atma, yourself, is not moving your body. Yourself is not moving.
Right.
You know, it's not moving, it's not thinking, it's not breathing. All of these activities belong to the creation, right? And so you're also not moving your body.
I guess you could also say that the thought to move the body or the will to move the body is also objectifiable.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Which isn't you. So
that's
not
right.
You either.
That's not you either. The subtle body is not you either.
I think that's another hard one for me. I think the touch. It's almost like my thoughts, the mind.
Yeah.
Is that like another sense organ or something?
Well, it's not exactly like another sense organ, but it's made of the same what we call sattva. It means the mind is always known. Right? Any thought you have, it's known. Right? And the sense organs are sattva also. It means they reflect intelligence. Now, so what you have to realize is that if you just sit quietly and you just become aware of your mind, you just realize, okay, this thought is known. Next up, this thought is known, this thought is known, this thought is known, this thought is known. But these known thoughts come and go, and you don't. So you have to, the being, the very fabric or the very existence and consciousness that the thought is enjoying, the very stuff of the thought is stable. But the thought keeps changing. Right? The content of the thought keeps changing. The consciousness of the thought doesn't change. The existence of the thought doesn't change at all. Doesn't waver at all. So now your mind's task is to recognize the consciousness, the changeless consciousness and existence of the mind, which is changeless, where the names and forms of the mind are changing. That's the distinction. Right? And my being is with the consciousness, not with the things that go. That's what makes it discernible, because there's something that doesn't about you that doesn't change at all, doesn't modify at all. That's what the mind can recognize, because the mind can differentiate between itself, which is keeps changing, right? And its being, which is constant. Does that make sense?
So as far as having no control of the body, is this what Swamiji means when he says like you don't even have control over your next thought?
He doesn't. That's yeah. I mean, you don't.
Right.
That's an important thing to understand. I mean, that's a big thing to realize also. If you don't have control over your next thought,
right.
then you can have, you don't have to own them. If you don't have a control over what thought's going to show up, then just like, you know, you don't have control over what you're going to see if your eyes are open and whatever's there is what you're going to see. So your thought, whatever comes, is what you're going to experience. But it's up to you whether or not you grab onto that thought. That's the Shama Dhamma. Or you can just let that thought move right along. You know?
But maybe because of desires we grab onto it.
Back in Vairagya, thinking things should be this way. If only things would be this way.
And also the breath. You know, we don't breathe the breath. The breath functions on its own. The heart has its own rhythm. There's nothing you control.
Yeah. You know that thing with the breath? It's when you do meditate, if you can relax and just be aware of the breathing, you breathe on your own. You're not ever, hardly ever aware of your breath. You're just breathing. You can relax and just let your body breathe. And just differentiate yourself. You're not breathing. Consciousness isn't breathing. You're just simply there. The body is breathing. That's a really beautiful and subtle exercise. You know, just to differentiate your own me, your own presence from the in and outgoing breath. Don't breathe, just let your body breathe. And you have just kind of.
It's the breath that comes and goes.
Yeah.
And I'm the one that stays.
Yeah. You never change, ever. The thoughts are changing, the breath is changing, the perceptions are changing, everything's changing except for you. And you're the very being of the whole thing. You know? There's none of it's away from you. That's again, like, think about if you have an imagination. There's not any part of that imagination that is not you. It has no existence apart from you. But none of it is you. The whole thing is you, none of it is you. Right? Because you're its being, but you don't change. Right? It enjoys, and if you have an imagination, it 100% is you, it enjoys you, there's not one part of it that isn't you, but you're not it.
So in the waking state, it's the same, except that the content, in a sense, is sort of given. In
the waking state, the content is Ishvara.
Yeah.
In your dream or imagination, the content, you're the Ishvara, you're the little Ishvara of that, right? This is the big Ishvara of which this body is a part. So there's an empirical reality here because this is not a projection of a jiva's mind. This is Ishvara, and these jivas are all part of it. Whereas if you have the jiva has a projection, an imagination, then the individuals within it, in the imagination, are part of that whole, right? And that's why it's very obvious for you to be able to say that imagination comes from me, is sustained by me, resolves into me, there's nothing there but me, it is me, right? But imagination totally depends upon me, but I'm more than it because the imagination can come and go and I remain exactly the same. So that's the situation here. The same me is the self of this whole. That's Ishvara. Where now this body, mind, sense organs is part of this imagination, this total imagination, Maya, the whole Maya.
I read a poem by Tagore a long time ago, and he was praying to Ishvara to wake up from his dreams so he could be free.
Well, Ishvara doesn't have a problem because not identified with anything in particular. I'm just it's a manifestation of infinite knowledge. So there's not any point of identification. I'm the whole. You know, like say if you have a dream where you're not identified with any given thing, you're just the whole. There's no problem. Like there's everything is taking place in you. But if you're a jiva within that, you need to be liberated. Because if you're identified from as a character within it, because it limited knowledge, you reflect awareness and all of that, but there's ignorance there, then you're subject to birth and death and, you know, having to become happy and being sad and all kinds of things. So you need to gain self-knowledge. Right? And so you can say, oh, everything's fine, there's no problem. Everything's fine. It was fine. It is fine now, and it will be fine. There's nothing anybody can do about it as it's finished. Okay. But this body will still die. These sense organs will still, you know, go through their change. But in terms of the reality of it, and of my own self, that won't die. That won't change. It never has and never will. And you know that for certain. You know it for certain, not as a concept also, but you know it for certain because that there's no other way it can be, and that is your experience. It's not. It's already your experience. It's not like you're having a hypothetical or a theoretical understanding of your nature. That is your nature. That is your nature, and you recognize it right now as direct, immediate understanding. See what I mean?
I've always said that you have to understand that it's not a philosophy. If it was, the self would be philosophized out. It's about you, self, and therefore it's a teaching.
It's a recognition. A recognition, and then you have to, there's logic involved. You have to see it and you have to understand. You have to see it and you have to understand what you see. Yeah. You better stop. Mm.